Well, we're glad you're here. Welcome to the November meeting of the Gonzaga Socratic Club. The Gonzaga Socratic Club takes its inspiration from the famous Oxford Socratic Club, which was founded at Oxford University in 1941 and was presided over by Christian scholar, author, and apologist C.S. Lewis from the time of the club's founding until he moved to Cambridge University in 1954. The purpose of the club is to promote open philosophical inquiry into the Christian worldview. And I should specify philosophical inquiry here means thoughtful and sustained reflection on the truth of Christian doctrine and practice and the Christian worldview. So we're honored to have non-philosophers on our panel today, and I wanted to make sure we're clear about that. Needless to say, the problem of evil is central to any thoughtful and sustained reflection on the claims and practice of the Christian life. The reality of evil and suffering is thought to provide the most compelling intellectual challenge to Christian belief by many people, adherents to and critics of Christianity alike. Why does a God who is powerful enough to prevent evil and suffering, benevolent enough to wish to prevent suffering, and wise enough to know how to prevent evil and suffering, allow evil and suffering to exist? Why, if the universe is ordered creatively by God as good, are evil and suffering so pervasive? How should we understand the phenomena of evil and suffering? Can a robustly orthodox conception of God be maintained in the face of the human experience of evil? A thoughtful treatment of the problem of evil requires that we explore the nature of evil, the impact of evil and suffering on human life, and the implications of evil and suffering for our understanding of God. To address the question of evil and suffering from a set of varied perspectives, we'll hear short presentations today from a set of panelists with diverse experience and interests. Our first panelist will be Dr. John Wagner, who's Associate Professor of Philosophy here at Gonzaga, where he has been a member of the department since 1981. He holds degrees from the Catholic University of America, and he has a particular interest in the phenomenon of evil that has led him across the years to develop a course on racism, slavery, and evil. Our second speaker is Laura Schmidt, who is a practicing psychotherapist and counselor. She holds degrees from Wheaton College and Syracuse University, including a master's in family and individual practice. She'll be speaking about the experience of evil, of human evil. Our third speaker is Father Paul Vebeck, who is pastor of Mary Queen Parish here in Spokane, Washington. He holds degrees from Gonzaga in religious studies and in theology, from the Catholic University of Louvain. Our final speaker is Chris Sparks, who is a major in philosophy and history, and is pursuing the Catholic Studies program here at Gonzaga. Chris has the distinction of being the first student presenter at the Gonzaga Socratic Club last fall on the topic of Catholic Mission at Gonzaga, a Student View. So I hope you'll welcome our speakers, and we'll hear from them, and then we'll have time at the end for questions and discussion. So, Dr. Wagner.
I've been asked to announce that there will be a test at the end of the session. This is on evil. And I get to do the philosophical side of this thing. The problem of evil, as I understand it, is an argument that the classical monotheistic idea of God is just wrong. This is the Jewish, Muslim, Christian idea of God as all powerful and all good. There's room here. It doesn't force the conclusion there is no God. You can look at the problem of evil and say, aha, this proves that there are multiple gods who don't get along very well with each other, and that explains what's going on in the world. But monotheism has trouble here. The argument at root is very simple. It operates by pointing to events in the world, which are really bad events, and arguing that an all-powerful, all-good God wouldn't permit these events. Not just it would be inconsistent for God to do these things, but it's inconsistent for an all-powerful God, all-good God, even to permit these things to happen. Now, some people can build an argument for the problem of evil off of minor evil, but usually it's done in terms of large scale, big time evil. Minor evil might turn out to be character forming. You want something really awful. And at this point, substitute whatever evil you want to put in. The usual shape of it is evil, an evil incident in which, to all we can tell, evil overcomes good. Evil wins. The reason this is really evil is it teaches you that you should be evil. It would be as if you watched the events on Wall Street of the last few months and came to the conclusion that, well, you run AIG, you run it into the ground, you waste billions and billions of dollars, disrupt the entire financial system, and they'll give you $150 billion. This is not a good lesson. This is the sort of thing you get in the problem of evil. People are being taught to do evil. Now, I want to take it from the point of view of a philosopher named Boethius. Boethius lived in the early 500s. He didn't get into trouble. A couple of liars got him into trouble. He ended up in jail waiting for execution. And the problem was that, as far as I can tell, this guy really was a good man, and he came from a good family. He was consul of the Roman Empire in 510, and both of his sons were simultaneously co-consul in 522. This was big-time accomplishment. And he ended up convicted of conspiracy to overthrow the Roman Empire because of the testimony of two convicted liars. And if you read through it, his concern isn't just that he's going to die and it's probably going to be unpleasant to die and it's really rotten to be in the jail cell. He's really upset that, to all appearances, evil can overcome good. That's the lesson of the whole sequence. That evil can overcome good. Good is going to fail and evil's going to win, and evil's going to win because it's evil and because good is wimpy. And he says, how can God allow this sort of thing? Now, it's really a good book, because it's great psychologically. Lady Philosophy shows up, talks to Boethius, and he complains for a while, and she says, well, what's the big deal? Other philosophers like Socrates have ended up getting killed too. You know, you're just another one. And he goes on about how miserable it is, and she comes to the conclusion that he's forgotten who he is, that she needs to take him through the basic stuff. And so she does a really good job of saying, look, happiness doesn't come from money, fame, power, sense pleasure, knocking out all the big candidates. And she presents arguments that evil people are weak and evil people never achieve happiness. And what's interesting is every single one of these arguments logically hangs together. And it's also interesting that none of them convince Boethius. It's really a good book that way. Read through it. He isn't buying this. 2 years earlier, when he was a professional philosopher, helper of emperors and so on, he was in great shape. But now this stuff is collapsing in front of him. And we want to look at how this thing works out. Before we do, I want to talk about something called burden of proof. This is technical philosophy. Here we go. Remember, the problem of evil is a challenge by somebody who says classical monotheism is wrong. They say they can definitively prove that there is an absolute contradiction which proves that the classical monotheists are simply wrong about God. There may be a polytheistic system or something else, but monotheists are just wrong on this one. Now, this is different from a Christian questioning evil in the world. I've read a number of authors who say, well, if you already know that God exists and God is good, you can be puzzled by these things, but it's no longer the problem of evil. This is a challenge. And the burden of proof is on the person who says they have absolute evidence that there is no God. It's important to remember this. That a response to the problem of evil is a response to somebody who has a burden of proof. And there are a lot of people who are very energetic about saying, yes, I can meet that burden of proof. I'm going to prove that God doesn't exist. So like I say, Lady Philosophy, for three and a half chapters, goes through all of these arguments, and Boethius just isn't convinced. So Lady Philosophy, at the end, pulls a different move. She asks Boethius, are human beings possessed of minds that are infallible? when they think that something is good, it's really good, and when they think it's evil, it's really evil. Now, this is more than the question, have you ever made a mistake about what's good and bad in your life? And all of us go, yeah, don't ask. And the next question is, have you ever made a big time mistake? And as you get older, yeah, really don't ask on that one. Lady Philosophy can point out that people have gigantic debates about what's good and evil. There are people who are absolutely convinced that abortion is evil, and people who are absolutely convinced that restrictions on abortion are evil. And they're very strongly convinced both ways. Now, they both can't be right. So human beings, it seems, are not infallible in this area. Now, what Boethius does in the book is very interesting, because you've actually got a logically complete case at this point. In order to meet the burden of proof, you've got to be absolutely sure about this good and evil thing. Human beings are not infallible on good and evil, so you can't be logically sure that you've carried your burden of proof. So the problem of evil is a challenge to monotheism, logically collapses, and Lady Philosophy knows she's got the logic, and Boethius knows she's got the logic, and when you read Boethius, he's still not convinced. You can tell he's going yes, 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 because he's logically backed into a corner, but he doesn't buy it. And that's where Lady Philosophy does something really interesting. This is a brilliant rhetorical move, and I'm sure it comes from Boethius' rhetorical training. Lady Philosophy sort of leans back and says, okay, I'll play your game. I will give you a whole batch of reasons why things look wrong. Boethius, you object to good people having rotten things happen to them, and rotten people having good things happen to them, and it's not even consistent, because sometimes good people have good things, good people have bad things, bad people have good things, bad people have bad things. What's going on? She says, well, I can't tell you what's going on in every case, but let's look at some possibilities. Some good people could be sort of weak. If put under extreme pressure, they might crack. Well, God might give them extra protection, so they won't crack. On the other hand, suffering without cracking testifies to the strength of moral goodness, and God could allow some good people to go through that. In fact, sometimes you achieve greater character by going through really awful events. I've read an awful lot of people who say that awful events have made them into much better people. I don't think I've done that well with my awful events, but apparently it works for some people. Some evil people might get a break from God because it'll keep them from doing worse things. Namely, when they get a certain amount of loot, they suddenly get afraid that they're going to lose their loot, and so they start watching their steps so that they can keep fame, wealth, and power. On the other hand, sometimes evil doesn't succeed because we want to show that evil is weak. Perhaps that's what God is what God is up to. If you allow good fortune to go to evil people, people will not equate good fortune with good moral character. If you note that you can lie, cheat, and steal your way to billions and billions of dollars, it dawns on you that billions and billions of dollars is not a sign of moral greatness. And Lady Philosophy gets on this roll, and you can tell she can keep this game going forever, name possible things that can be achieved. She's not claiming any one of them is the key. And at this point, Boethius says, okay, you're right. I can't see clearly enough to say there's conclusive proof that God is blowing it, or there is no God. The argument fails when you feel in your gut that it fails, and it's by seeing a wide range of possibilities, not just the theoretical argument. It's always interesting to me, because logically the argument works before it persuasively works in the book. And it works at that point. You can't meet the burden of proof, and the problem of evil more or less collapses at that point. I wanted to end, even though I'm not a theologian, and I've talked to theologians who've done advanced doctoral research on this, and I've discovered that I have an idiosyncratic view of the book of Job. But it seems to me that God is a very good philosopher in the book of Job. Because in the opening scene, there's a God sitting around with the sons of God, presumably archangels of some sort, and Satan came along with him. Satan shows up here, And God says, where have you been? And Satan says, I've been going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down upon it. And God says, have you considered my servant Job? There's nobody like him. He's upright and blameless, and he fears God, and he turns away from evil. And Satan says, yeah, Job's got it real nice. You protect him from rotten things happening to him. You give him a great family. You give him a lot of wealth. Everything. He's even got good health. See what happens if he hasn't got those things. And God says, okay, you're on. This is a bet. There are no stakes named. And God says, you can't harm physically Job himself. But outside of that, you can do anything you want. And so Satan does anything he wants, and Job loses everything. His family dies and loses all his fortune. And he ends up in the city dump, living in horrible circumstances. And there's this big, long discussion between three helpful-meaning people and Job. And Satan predicts that Job will curse God, and Job never does curse God. But Job is really ticked off with God, and he wants an explanation. And God, having read Boethius ahead of time, comes back with the ignorance example, because think about it for a minute. Job can't know what's going on. Suppose you have somebody who really loves God, and God himself comes up and says, could you do me a favor? Well, now just a minute, God tells me, do this, don't do this, you know, and all the normal stuff, but God has really never asked me to do him a favor. Job is going to say, God just asked me to do a favor. You're on. It's not going to work if Job knows the story. Job has to be in ignorance. And the answer God gives, he doesn't tell him that there was a bet. God speaks out of the whirlwind, and his opening lines are, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determines its measurements? Surely you know. You know, if you're so sure, you know. And God proceeds to cross-examine Job, although Job never gets a chance to answer. It becomes very obvious very fast that human ignorance is such that we can never be sure enough of the claims and the problem of evil. And that's what I wanted to accomplish in my few minutes here, is to get everybody to see that the problem of evil is an attack on classical monotheism, and it's an attack that fails because of the fallibility of human understanding of good and evil. I hope I haven't used more than my time. I'll pass it on.
Okay. Ms. Smith now.
One contribution that psychotherapy can offer to a philosophical discussion of theodicy is focusing on the way an experience of evil and one's faith in God impacts one's identity and sense of self. And that's what, since that's what I do for a living, is working with people and their self-identity and self-worth, that's the angle I'm going to take today, which is a little bit different from a philosophical perspective. And I'll give you, I just want to give you a little bit of background about me, because I think that informs, well, my sense of self and my experience of evil and how I approach this whole issue. So I have, religiously, I have a pretty diverse background. I was confirmed in the Lutheran Church, and then during high school, I kind of moved away from liturgical worship and got involved in non-denominational charismatic churches. I was participated in Young Life, and then I went off to Wheaton College and ended up actually getting back into the Episcopal Church. And then after college, I lived in a, yeah, it's kind of all over the place. I lived in a Catholic lay apostolate in rural Canada as a guest volunteer for about 9 months. So, and basically, until my mid-20s, I would say, I hadn't experienced a whole lot of evil directly, personally. I was certainly aware of the evil in the world, but it was at a distance. And it wasn't direct enough in my life or in the lives of my family and close friends for me to call into question my sense of self or my own self-worth or my faith in God. Then as I got a master's degree in marriage and family therapy from Syracuse University, and it was really once I started working with clients in the therapy room that I began having direct contact and interaction with survivors and perpetrators of intense evil or trauma. And I'd like to distinguish the difference between an evil event versus a traumatic one. And this is really my definition of these two, so we can discuss this further at the end if you'd like. I see evil as describing the intent of the offender, and trauma describing the experience of the victim. So evil is coming from the intent of the person committing the evil act, and trauma is describing the experience of the person experiencing that evil act. So speaking from that angle of human experience, my role as a therapist is to be present with my clients in their pain and their confusion and anger, and to support them in their path to healing, whatever that may entail for this particular client. I help clients identify resources internally and externally to support them in their journey. And a person's faith can play an important role in this recovery process, and an experience of evil can reshape a person's faith in unexpected ways. For some clients that I've worked with, their faith is what keeps them going. It's what keeps them alive. It gives them hope. It helps them continue to believe in the goodness of humanity. For others, their faith only contributes to their anguish and confusion. These clients may eventually lose their faith temporarily or permanently because it isn't helping the pain and distress caused by the evil act. Their faith may, in fact, intensify the pain and distress. So I'd like to begin by asking, well, I have three questions that I want to pose to you that that come up in therapy when dealing with evil or trauma. And the first question is, why me? In psychotherapy, the questions that an evil act raises aren't just about theodicy, whether or not God exists, or why this happened, although those questions certainly come up, and they're important. The question that arises stems from the personhood, or the identity of the victim and their sense of self. An evil act involuntarily, uncontrollably ruptures one's sense of self. It disrupts a victim's identity. It throws everything upside down. And victims of evil acts often ask, why me? Why was I chosen out of all the girls at this party? How come I was the one that got raped that night? Why was I chosen out of all my other siblings to be abused by my step-parent? In broadening that, I realize some of my examples, a lot of them may come from two specialties for me are working with survivors of sexual trauma and working with eating disorders. So you may hear those examples more than others. But thinking in a broader perspective around health issues, people asking, why did I get cancer? When I exercise, I've gone to the doctor every year, I eat right. Couples dealing with infertilities, you know, someone can't get pregnant or carry a baby to full term. Car accidents, natural disasters. There's often the question that comes up, why me? How did I get picked to suffer in this way? And for Christians, faith is a crucial component to the development of one's sense of self and their identity. I'm a child of God with worth. If this happened to me, does this make me less worthy? How does God see me now? How do I see me now? Now that I've experienced an evil act and maybe it's tainting my sense of myself. There are explanations that probably many of you have heard around trying to help, and there's one from 1 Corinthians, you've heard this before, God will never give you more than you can handle. Well, you know, that's meant to help, but often when a victim hears that or someone who's really dealing with a hard time, you know, they're thinking, well, I'm having trouble handling this, so what does that mean? Am I bad? Am I less than because God can't give me more than I can handle? Now what? I'm not handling it. So a second question after why me is, who am I? A traumatic act impacts one's own personal identity, and there's a desperate attempt for understanding and explanation. The evil act or the trauma confuses and disrupts one's sense of self, especially because a victim may often feel that they were selected for their best parts. It was the parts of them that gave them their identity and their uniqueness, the parts that that maybe the offender sought out, and qualities like their attractiveness or their vibrancy, their curiosity, their innocence, their trust. These parts that are seen as attracting or causing the victimization, they become exiled and locked away and hidden. It's not safe anymore to display these positive qualities, so we just bury them. In the example of working with clients with eating disorders, it's not uncommon for a victim of a sexual assault to develop an eating disorder and gain or lose weight in order to feel less attractive or sexually desirable. If faith was a big part of a client's sense of self, that often gets disrupted and turned upside down. And the third question that comes up in therapy is moving from identifying as a victim to a survivor. And when someone comes into me, typically they're in a place of feeling like a victim, and they want to move into being less defined by that. Part of the healing is regaining one's sense of self. For someone that comes in, for example, as a rape victim, they often feel like this globally defines me. I have it written across my forehead. That's all people will see when they look at me. I can't interact with anyone without feeling like this is all I am. The identification as a victim feels all-encompassing and it's global. So the client doesn't want to be defined by this victimhood anymore, but they're scared to let go of it. A question comes up of, do I have to let go of my identity as a victim if I move to being a survivor? It's sort of this dance of, well, is it either or once I'm a survivor, what do I do with all these thoughts and this reality of, well, this happened to me? And it's sort of balancing those two states that comes up in trying to make sense of one's identity having experienced an evil act. And then finally, I'll put this out there. I think there's obviously room for discussion around this question, especially as it pertains to people of faith and where does God fit into this, around the question of forgiveness. If I want to move from feeling identified as a victim, move away from feeling that, does that mean I have to forgive my offender? Can I move forward in my healing if I can't forgive my offender? And this question comes up a lot. I'm with clients and they've come from church that Sunday and their pastor or their priest is preaching about God commands us to forgive, sinners need to be forgiven. And I mean, this is not uncommon where I'm hearing, a client just sobbing, thinking, wait, this pull of God asked me to forgive, my priest or pastor is asking me to forgive, and I'm not in a place right now to forgive my offender. I mean, they may be years from that, and they may be a lifetime from that. And there's a real conflict there of what is best for client, what's best for offender, what do you do with that, and then dealing with a person or a victim of a crime where they're trying to figure out, am I a bad person, am I a bad child of God if I can't forgive? I think that addresses what I'd like to share with you today, so I'll stop.
Father Bevick. Pope Benedict XVI gave a speech in Regensburg, Germany, in which he spoke about Christianity's engagement with the Enlightenment. Reason, said the Pope, is the foundation of Western thought and culture, just as it is fundamental to the thought and culture of the Church. When a culture abandons reason as a basis for thought and action, an anti-human reality is created, and when religion abandons reason, its theology and action becomes fanatical and anti-human. Now, the Pope has thought deeply about the important issues of our shared humanity for more than 80 years. The encyclical letter, Saved in Hope, given just about a year ago, gives us some of his mature thinking about the problem of evil. The heaped-up evil of the world can lead to a heart and mind without hope. And so what I have to say today is pretty much a summary of some aspects of that encyclical letter in which he talks about it. Now, one of the nice things about the Vatican and about the Pope is that since he's become Pope, you can get everything he's ever said or done on the internet. So that's vatican.va. if you speak English, then you have to click on English. And then there's a picture of him, and put the little hand on either his name or his picture, and you'll get into homilies and addresses and encyclicals. Everything is worth reading. Benedict writes in his encyclical, Paul reminds the Ephesians that their encounter with Christ, before their encounter with Christ, they were without hope and without God in the world. Imagine living without hope and without God in the world. The gospel is not merely the communication of things that can be known. It is a proclamation that makes things happen and is life-changing. The dark door of time. The door to the future has been thrown open by Christianity. The one who has hope lives differently. The one who hopes has been granted a gift of new life. And to live without God is to live without hope. This is the dilemma of Western civilization. In rejecting God, it's rejected hope. Without hope, evil triumphs and carries the day. Christian hope is the one adequate response to the problem of evil in the world. An adequate description of human nature requires the elements of reason and freedom. Reason allows us to make moral judgments. Reason is truly human, the Pope says, only if it is capable of directing the will along the right path, and it is capable of this only if it looks beyond itself. Otherwise, man's situation, in view of the imbalance between his material capacity, science and technology gives us great tools, but there is a lack of judgment in his heart, and therefore becomes a threat for him, his material capacity, becomes a threat for him and for creation. Rational moral judgments require reason and freedom. As to freedom, he writes, the moral treasury of humanity is not readily at hand like tools we use. Our moral life is present as an appeal to freedom and a possibility for freedom. However, he puts two major points. The right state of human affairs, the moral well-being of the world, can never be guaranteed simply through structures alone. The state, hospitals, schools, whatever it might be. Financial systems. However good these structures may be, the world can never be set right by them. Such structures are not only important, but they're necessary, yet they cannot and must not marginalize human freedom. Let's not let the state become communistic and totalitarian. Even the best structures function only when the community is animated by convictions capable of motivating people to assent freely to the social order. Freedom requires conviction. Conviction does not exist on its own, but must be gained anew, year by year, by each new community and its new members. Secondly, the Pope says, since man always remains free, and since his freedom is always fragile, the kingdom of good will never be definitively established in this world. We can't look to this world for a world without evil, for example. Anyone who promises the better world that is guaranteed to last forever here is making a false promise. He is overlooking human freedom. Freedom must constantly be won for the cause of good. Free assent to the good never exists simply in itself. if there were structures which could irrevocably guarantee a determined good state of the world, man's freedom would be denied, and hence they would not be good structures at all. Imagine the Catholic Church making a plea for freedom. Evil results from a moral lapse, from a lack of reason, from the selfish use of freedom that exploits other people and creation. The ordering of the world we long for is not given by the state, or by science, or by romantic longing. The world we long for is given to man only through love. And although our human loving is inadequate, it points us in the right direction. The fulfillment of the human heart is through love. Love is the answer to the problem of evil in the world. And the definitive act of love for the world, you're not ready for this, the definitive act of love for the world is found in the Christian dogma of the Last Judgment. There, love will judge between good and evil, and the confused reality of our lived lives will be seen in limpid, lucid clarity. The love that judges evil will be demonstrated by Christ, who is coming to judge the living and the dead. It is an hour of justice produced by God. Humanity cannot produce justice in the world. Where it tries, it is false and leads to the greatest forms of cruelty and the greatest violations of justice. A world that produces its own justice is a world without hope. And yet, we long for a world where present suffering would be wiped out and the irrevocable past would be undone. We want a world where all the heaped up suffering that is present is done away with and all the evil of the past would be undone. The Last Judgment then is about hope. The human heart longs for fulfillment that is always denied us in this life. Humanity seeks an everlasting love that is given only in eternity. The injustice of this world, the suffering of the innocent, cannot be the last word. Hope allows God to set things right. The Last Judgment is about justice, but also about grace. The Last Judgment, in the face of the crucified and risen Christ, there we will see justice and grace in their correct inner relationship. Grace does not cancel out justice. Grace does not make wrong into right. Grace is not a sponge that wipes everything away. All that has been done on earth is not of equal value. Evildoers in the end do not sit at table at the eternal banquet beside their victims as if nothing had happened. Justice must be served. When we die, our life choice becomes definitive. Our life stands before Christ the judge. Our choices take on a certain shape during the course of our entire life. And at the end, when we die, that's the shape in which we meet the judge. We can envision three possibilities for the final shape of one's life. There's the first shape, evil. There can be people who have totally destroyed the desire for truth, their readiness for love, people where everything has become a lie, people who have lived for hatred, people who have suppressed all love within themselves. This is a terrifying thought, yet our own history shows us certain figures like this. In such people, all would be beyond remedy. The destruction of good is irrevocable, and this is what we mean by hell. A second possibility, the good shape of life. There can be people who are utterly pure, permeated by God, and thus fully open to their neighbor. People in deep communion with God, who gives their entire life and being direction. People whose journey to God at their death only brings to perfection what they already are. So the evil shape of a life, the good shape of a life, and then the third possibility he gives us, neither case. Neither case is normal in human life. For the great majority of people, there is in the depths of their being a heartfelt openness to truth, to love, and to God. But in everyday choices of daily living, there are compromises with evil. Much filth covers purity. But the thirst for truth, for love, for God, constantly re-emerges and remains present within the person. What will happen to such people of this third possibility when they appear before the judge? Will the evil they have amassed through life suddenly cease to matter? Not at all. The church uses the image of fire, burning away what is base, purifying what is incomplete. One passes as if through fire, so as to become fully open to receiving God and prepared to take one's place at the table in the eternal feast. At the last judgment, before the face of Christ, in the fire of his love, all falsehood in our life melts away. We are transformed. We are free at last. We become truly ourselves. We see what we chose as evil. What we built from straw will be burned away. All our bluster and pride will collapse. In the pain of this encounter, as the impurity, the sickness, the evil of our lives becomes evident to us, therein lies our hope. For all this is burned away in the fire of divine love. The face of Christ, his gaze upon us, the touch of his heart, heals us through an undeniably painful transformation as through fire. The justice of God and the grace of God become clear to us for the first time. The way we live our lives is significant. Yet the evil does not stain us forever. Evil was present at the same time as we reached out toward God, truth, and love. The last judgment is a reckoning of what we did in this world, good and evil, and the triumph of justice, grace, and love established in humanity by Christ, who has given us hope and God in the world.
Real quick, I see some of you shifting. If you need to stand up, go ahead real quick. Might as well do that now. Hey, yes, Father. Anyone? I know what it feels like to sit on the floor at a lecture for that long. And if anyone wants to come in, there is some more room in here. I've seen people sort of sitting outside the door listening. If you all want to actually sit. Yeah, don't leave restaurants. Yeah, I know. Oh, well. Terribly. And now I'll actually start talking. This isn't exactly going to be quite like the other three papers. This wasn't nearly so scholastic. It's going to be sort of a chaser after the harder stuff. I had the opportunity to work on that Dark Knight paper contest the last 2 weeks ago, I think now. And when this came up, I pulled some of it together because it fits really quite well with evil suffering and God and all that. So that's what you're going to hear. Evil can be hard to see in this modern age of tolerance of all viewpoints and acceptance of every choice. and suffering makes no sense in the age of anesthesia, euthanasia, and our society of instant gratification. Sometimes a concept is best understood when given a face, a name, and a story, even if the story is horrifying. The Joker, from the recent Batman blockbuster, offers what may be the best portrayal of the devil ever. This offers the perfect vehicle for a discussion of evil. In the interests of time, I'm going to do a really, really brief job on suffering. It deserves a lot more than I'm going to have time to give it. The opening scene of The Dark Knight establishes the whole of the Joker's character arc remarkably well. And really quick, who here has not seen the movie? All right, if you have to cover your ears at certain points, you can cover your ears and I won't be offended. The opening scene, he has successfully slaughtered his confederates or manipulated them into slaughtering each other. We are presented with the liar and the destroyer here. And really quick, Scott Peck was a psychologist and a Christian, and he had written a book called People of the Lie, in which he postulates that evil, human evil, is characterized by an inability to face the truth. So that, you know, that warping aside from truth is inherent to the very idea of evil itself. And he spoke of his experiences in psychology, in psychotherapy, with people who, quite literally, he could not help because they could not acknowledge the truth of the world, their situation, so forth. As the Joker is sauntering towards his getaway bus, the banker mobster on the floor behind him calls, "The criminals in this town used to believe in things. Honor. Respect. Look at you. What do you believe in? What do you believe in?" The Joker unveils his painted mask for the first time in the movie and grins. "I believe whatever doesn't kill you simply makes you stranger." Here in this telling one-liner at the start of the movie, we are given a glimpse of the heart of the beast. Does everything short of death simply twist us, make us stranger, and divert us further from the normal? The Joker believes in corruption, a point reinforced at each and every turn of the movie. He is clearly the devil figure in this spiritual drama. The tempter, the tester, set loose for a time in Gotham to act as an acid on everyone within. You'll see. I'll show you. When the chips are down, these people, these civilized people, they'll eat each other. You see, I'm not a monster. I'm just ahead of the curve. The rest of the world is just as scarred and just as ugly as he is, or at least he thinks so. You see, madness, as you know, is like gravity. All it takes is a little push. His faith is in faithlessness, in evil and distortion. In a sense, the Joker is the ultimate anti-hypocrite. He knows as a dogmatic article of faith that the entire world is one weeping sore, one massive scar that we paint over in an attempt to conceal it, in an attempt to look like something we're not. So he is determined to rip away the mask, to dissect and probe with the scalpel, to expose the true face of the world. The Joker believes that by proving Gotham's citizens are, when pressed, just as animalistic as he is, the spirit of the city will break and be damned. Liberty will be denied, either by the law's efforts to restore order, or by the anarchistic chaos descending on a totally corrupt, irredeemable city. But the citizens of Gotham collectively are better than that. The captain of the vessel Liberty realizes what it means to still be alive. The passengers in the prisoner ship have not taken their lives. Similarly, on Spirit, one prisoner talks the government official holding the trigger to the other ship's explosives into handing it over, and the thief then throws it over the side. In both cases, the strength, sanity, and essential human decency of the common man defeat the Joker's expectations. In a word, the world is essentially good. There is a backdrop of goodness, even as foul as it is. The world is, at its root, good. But the Joker's faith is not shattered, an anomaly, nothing more. Indeed, he has even planned for failure with the social experiment by destroying the spirit and liberty of Harvey Dent, described by Gordon as the best of us. So instead of having to go after everyone, if he can go after one man, he thinks that will do just as well. The Dark Knight presents us with a fairly clear Christian symbolist drama, where the whole plot is, as the Joker says, while dangling upside down over a fall into the abyss, because that's not blatantly obvious, the battle for Gotham's soul between the devil, or the Joker, and Christ, or guardian angel, Batman. The way the Joker tempts and tests people the entire way through, the lies regarding his scars, how he first got injured, how he became what he was, the inhumanly complex and yet successful plans, his rather dramatic role-playing as high priest on the Aztec-style pyramid made out of money, on which Lao is burned alive in retribution for his treachery, the whole aspect of him being an anarchist who breaks every rule, shatters every boundary, and overturns every authority perhaps all the way up to God himself. This is the devil as he deserved to be played. To those of us who believe that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and it was good, we see the Joker's efforts as akin to the calculated blasphemies of a practitioner of black magic, or the sort of training in objectivity described by C.S. Lewis in That Hideous Strength, which everyone here should read. Never before had he known the frightful strength of the movement opposite to nature, which now had him in its grip, the impulse to reverse all reluctances and to draw every circle anti-clockwise. The meaning of certain pictures, of Frost's talk about objectivity, of the things done by witches in old times became clear to him, the process whereby all specifically human reactions were killed in a man so that he might become fit for the fastidious society of the devils. Higher degrees in the asceticism of anti-nature would doubtless follow, the eating of abominable food, the dabbling in dirt and blood, the ritual performances of calculated obscenities, turning everything upside down, doing the exact opposite of the way everything ought to work, breaking everything merely because it works, because we cannot stand that it works. From the first sequence of the movie to the end, the Joker attempts to prove the truth of his faith and faithlessness, and the twisting of all things from their proper orientation to disorder. The goal is not mere chaos, the goal is the breaking of the law. And I need to be really clear here. When I'm speaking of law, I'm talking about the most fundamental, basic, rooted precepts, the things that this world would not work without. You know, it's not a mere thing of, oh, gee, you know, Catholics no fish on Fridays, or, you know, the speed limit is 65 miles an hour. We're talking about things like reason. Reason works. Human comprehension works. And if you overturn these sort of fundamental things, you are doing evil to a person. If you drive a person mad, you have done him a deep evil. If you kill a person unjustly, you have done them a deep evil, this sort of thing. In a universe ordered by an ultimately good and loving lawgiver, set in motion by utter truth and justice, deviations from the norm do not reveal originality or creativity. A being is never creative by cutting themselves off from the creator himself. Rather, all that comes out is sterility and death, a terrible wasted depression calling from the depths of a self-imposed exile, from all that gives existence meaning. As Lewis described in the Screwtape Letters, one of the most terrible realizations of the souls, afforded the peculiar clarity of the miserific vision, is the realization that they had spent their lives doing neither what they wanted nor what they ought. The great goal of the tempters, says Screwtape, is to bring the patients to the point where they will sin and receive nothing in return. No pleasure, no distraction, no ease or comfort. Back to the Joker. The Joker takes a crazed delight in his work, but there is no true satisfaction there for him. He got bored with the old way crime worked in Gotham and had to raise the stakes in the card game for Gotham's soul. He occasionally betrays by a look or a gesture exactly how desolate he is internally, reduced from humanity to a mere hunger, a need for what exactly? He's a dog chasing cars. He wouldn't know what to do with one if he caught it. He's an animal throwing himself in harm's way because he may loathe himself more than he loathes the rest of the world. He bristles angrily at the suggestion that he's a freak, and then gleefully informs Batman that the two of them together are the freaks of the city, both of whom are equally despised by the civilized people. There's hell for you, all wrapped up in one cackling package. If he ever succeeded in his anarchistic quest to break the world and destroy the civilized people, if he ever gained the world, it would profit him nothing, because he wouldn't know what to do with it once he'd broken it. As Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle knew, evil is mere privation. It cannot exist on its own. Anne Rand, with the little clarity she had left from Aristotle, used that truth as the centerpiece of Atlas Shrugged. When the Creator falls silent, all the noise of the devil cannot even be heard. When Christ dies, the devil is hurled to a fate worse than death, being ultimately powerless. And then my really abbreviated treatment of suffering. We live in a world gone awry, way back at the beginning of things, distorted from what it should have been. And I think everyone has that sense at some point in their life that something's just not right. As with all great injuries, there's a great deal of therapy involved, and therapy means pain. To what extent was it all part of the plan at the beginning? To what extent would we have suffered even without the great mistake? God only knows. Perhaps suffering was to have been a mere tool, not a burden. And now in this economy of salvation, we are faced with terrible costs, terrible choices to make, and prices to pay. Suffering can also be alleviated by following the natural order as best we possibly can. This is a point drawn wonderfully by Wendell Berry in his discussion of the great economy versus the industrial economy, about how nature curses hubris and rewards diligence and hard work, working within the boundaries we have been given in nature. But prices must be paid. This is wisdom from all ages and cultures and nations. There is no way to forever put aside paying debt. There is no eternal rise towards utopia. There are good times and bad times, rising and falling, strength and weakness, youth and old age. The price one generation refuses to pay must be paid by a later generation at many times the cost. Not only is the suffering of the day sufficient, it must be endured so that the times to come shall be endurable. The highest price of all, that debt which no one of us could have paid, has been offered up by God to God, of course. But there's still a great deal to be built, to be endured. There are evils to fight, and works to undertake, and prayers to be said, and people to be loved in spite of all the reasons not to. There's love's labors to be done, and love's labors are never lost. God sees to that.
Thank you to our four speakers. Given us a great deal to chew on and think about, and as is the tradition here at the Socratic Club, we promote pursuing the conversation. So if you have questions, we'd like to entertain those. If you want to direct a question to one speaker in particular, you can do that, or you can just raise a question and we can let our speakers address it in turn. Let's keep the questions brief since there are so many of us here today, but let's have it. Questions? Go ahead.
In your opinion, do you have to let go of being a victim in order to be a survivor?
I was looking at my notes, and in answering to your question, I realized there are some things I skipped over. Well, that's part of the dilemma of balancing the two, and it comes up a lot in therapy, and I have to say it depends on the client. I mean, some... It's figuring out to find the balance of how do I let go of being a victim, feeling like a victim, and embracing feeling like a survivor. But what do I do about that experience? I can't forget that that happened to me, but I don't want to be defined by it. So it's that's part of the conflict, you know. And I think some ultimately for healing, it's. I think it's stepping into feeling like a survivor, not being defined by feeling like a victim, but honoring that experience and recognizing this did happen to me. I think that's a difficult question, though, because if I reclaim my identity as a victim, does that mean that I'm reaccusing my attacker, you know, and trying to move away from that? So does that answer your question? Okay, it's not concrete, I'll say that.
But this can be to anyone. It directly goes to the father's reading of the Pope's thing. But if man is free, then it seems as though in this world we like to accredit, or people of faith like to accredit, God with the good acts and people with the bad acts. So if man is truly free, should we not be accrediting God with any of them? Because if you accredit him with the good acts, how can you dismiss him from the bad?
We're talking about our activity, okay, and our nature. Okay, so if we're free, then, and we have reason, we can abuse all that we know from evil, that we can abuse all these things, okay? So we don't look to God as the one who's going to make things right by fiat and by force, but he's made things right through the mystery of faith, through the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that is an invitation to love, an invitation to authentic freedom, an invitation to goodness. So God is making the world better, or God is active in the world through that invitation to authentic human living.
How is that invitation, being a blank slate as it is, not an equal invitation to the other end of evil?
Oh, people are free. They can go to that other end.
So he gives an invitation to evil and good then, if I understand correctly.
Yes. But it's a privation again, remember? If people want to live in privation, then they can do that. But there's no hope for love. There's no hope for satisfaction. There's no hope for fulfillment without the choice.
Go ahead. Yes.
This is something that you're something you read two Etna, earthquakes,
famine,
drought. Well, we do have St. Paul's address to that dilemma, which is that even creation is broken and injured cumulatively over time, and so we have to live with that. We are conditioned by the world in which we do live, okay? And so if you live near a volcano, you're going to have to do that. Now, we can't get away from tsunamis, I suppose, so we can't move away from that. But the natural world, it is a place of danger and adventure, and some people thrive with it, and other people become victims of it. So I think we could accommodate and adjust to the natural evils or disasters of the world much more better than we could adapt to the moral evils of the world.
It is interesting to our whole panel. Most of what our panel had to say focused on moral evil, and that is an interesting question to think about. The difference that we respond to natural evils, things like earthquakes and so forth. Ms. Schmidt, you touched on sometimes you counsel people who are in accidents, and they ask the same kinds of questions. Is your experience that moral evil and natural evil have the same kind of effect on a victim?
I'm thinking the effect on the victim is similar, but the sort of the journey towards understanding and healing or resolution varies based on sort of the source of the evil act. So I was thinking in response to a natural disaster, you sort of learn to believe they're predictably unpredictable, and there's some peace in that, actually. But I think the response could be similar, but then in looking at sort of the dialogue about, even the question of why me, or why was my family swept away in the tsunami versus why was my sister sexually assaulted, it is a different question and experience, so...
Dr. Wagner, were you thinking something in particular?
It was something that was said earlier, but I think there are cases of evil. What really gets named evil is when it looks like somebody has deliberately picked you out, that there's an intention behind it. It's one thing, if a tornado comes through and wipes you out. It's another thing if a batch of Nazis decide that they don't like you because you're Jewish, and that's why they came after you. And I think that when people think about evil, I think that's where they cluster. I think that's right. Tornadoes are kind of random, but there are people who aren't random at all. They know what they're after, and there's an intention behind it.
Right.
Can I add something to that? I think that in contrasting sort of a natural occurrence of evil versus this moral evil act or done by a person, that's part of the crazy-making quality is when someone feels, I was personally selected. I was chosen out of, this room, and boom, I was the one that was shot or whatever. That's an additional trauma, I think, that adds a level of complexity, makes it harder.
Go ahead.
Also, this sort of goes directly back to the Wendell Berry thing I was talking about earlier. He talks about the great economy and makes the point specifically that it is beyond human comprehension, in that it is so vast and its workings are, some of its workings are so far from our experience, or in fact anything we shall ever experience, and yet occasionally they do ripple back and touch our lives. It's sort of like, C.S. Lewis having the multiverse theory long before any scientist was talking about it seriously. You look at the Chronicles of Narnia, you've got worlds upon worlds, and Jadis comes marching into ours from dying Charn. It's a totally, well, not totally accidental, but it makes no sense from the sheerly earthly perspective. Who is this woman, and what's she doing barging up and down the city streets, knocking policemen over the head with lamppost bits that she's torn off, and turning horses into a frenzy? Well, there's a whole backstory there. But we will never learn that. There are elements of this world which we are not given to understand. not because we couldn't conceivably if they were explained to us, but because it's none of our business. In a certain sense, you know, it's God is greater than that, and God's creation is greater than that. And so, and that's one element of the answer, that we are part of something larger than we could ever possibly imagine. And it sometimes shakes the earth from under our feet. But again, good wins in the end, I think, is the key thing. You know, good wins over evil, love triumphs over evil. And the story ends happily.
It seems like there's a constant thing, yours in particular, was that Dr. Wagner was that, that we just don't know the full implications, and that kind of ignorance will never get us to the problem of evil. But in some sense, it seems like this epistemological problem on our part is irrelevant to the fundamental problem of the argument against God's existence, or at least against a certain conception of God, because if evil exists, whether we know it or not, and God allows it, then this concept of an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good God doesn't make sense, regardless of whether or not we understand it. It seems like, nonetheless, if God allows evil things, then it's still a problem whether or not we get it or not. I mean, however stupid we might be, or ignorant, or incapable, just doesn't really matter, right? Because you still have this all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good God, allegedly, that allows evil things to happen, right? And at some point, it seems like you would have to go to the extreme to say, then there just really is no evil, right, at all. We just don't understand when we think it's evil. Really, there's probably some good in the end that it serves or whatever. And that seems, I don't see how you could ever possibly rationalize something like genocide. Right, and say that somehow that serves for good, somehow. And we just don't get it. Right, I mean, regardless of our knowledge of it.
Well, then you're going to have to give me the proof that it is absolutely impossible that genocide could do some good. I mean, it's emotionally heavy to throw that out there. But this is a claim people have, that they have an absolute proof that the classical monotheistic God doesn't exist. And I don't see where the case has been made.
I'll
play the ignorance card. It's a pretty strong card to play. And if somebody's going to come back and say, well, this is absolutely intolerable, okay, you're sure it's absolutely intolerable. Tell me why. Make it good. Real good.
I think if you make the problem of evil not an argument that God doesn't exist, but God doesn't merit moral praise, right, would be another. If God exists, if he does exist, then he's the sort of God that allows genocide. And frankly, I mean, if genocide is somehow a good thing, I can't understand it. And I think Dostoevsky brings up a point at one point where he says, even if, when I show up in heaven, it all makes sense, frankly, the suffering of that many people isn't worth it. I don't want to understand it. It's not worth the moral cost that it would take to justify the horrors that we see in the world.
Saying that, you've decided that I just won't look any answer to this. This is too much suffering. There is no answer. I won't look at them. That's exactly what he said. I don't care if I get to heaven and it all makes sense. No, I won't look at it. That doesn't carry the problem of evil.
Well, I think still the problem that I suppose you haven't addressed would be you would have to say there is no such thing as evil, right, in order to
I don't see
it.
Why.
Because if God allows evil, then evil is something immoral, right? Then you have an all good, all perfect God that allows evil. And that's the basic argument you have there. So you have to say there just is no such thing as evil.
Pick up your line here, I think you're going to say it. That's what people like Augustine say, that evil is, if you want to shift metaphysical, it's a fair move, that evil is simply a lack, it's a nothing. Somebody has just failed to be what they should be.
Then why would God allow this lack?
There's a thing called freedom.
Yeah.
You could have a world without that sort of event if you simply said, well, there will be no free creatures. There will be no evil, but there will also be no Yankees playing the Red Sox in the World Series.
I think you can make a case. I don't want to keep babbling here, but I think you can make a case that even the concept of free will, God doesn't give us an unrestricted free will by any stretch. Right? I mean, I can't, for example, walk off the building and levitate because I will it. Right? God created
but you can
the world
will it
in such a way.
But you can will it. You may not be able to do it, but you can will it.
I can't will. I mean, I can will a kind of yes. thing, but I can't actually accomplish anything that I will.
But this ties in. I mean, this ties into the Christian understanding of evil as not merely the external action, but also the internal disposition. You know, Christ talking about if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, you have committed adultery. You know, this is, you know, key. That not all evil need be expressed. You know, you've got the possibility of damnation because of anger, not because you had killed a million people, but because you were consistently, everlastingly angry, and you didn't ever let it go. I think somewhere that should go with God allowing suffering. You cannot just start with the well, God is good. Evil is bad, therefore God could not allow evil. It's got to also look at what sort of God are we talking about? We're talking about, with the good monotheistic God, the God who allowed the Jews to be driven from their homeland by the Babylonians, who instructs his followers to pick up their cross and follow him, who informs them that those who are most loyal to him will probably suffer the most. You know, and so for God to permit evil and suffering is not a strength, it is commanded. You know, it is required. It is a must happen thing. You know, why does he permit his son to die? Well, so that all people may be saved. Is the death of a million human beings worse than the death of the Son of God? You know, if you're going to try to evaluate life or evaluate worth on the scale of being, God is higher than the human. You know, it's like 10 million ants versus 10 million human beings. Well, human beings, 10 million human beings, God Almighty. Well. I suppose the real answer, the ultimate answer, is he participates in it. Why does he allow suffering? Well, he has suffered with us, so can you challenge him on that, I guess? I got confused towards the end. Does that make any sense?
Well, one thing that makes sense is, and I always notice this, that the Bible is very clear that there's an awful lot of suffering and a lot of bad guys winning in this world. You know, you can't read through the Bible and have this naive approach that, oh, being a good person is the recipe for wealth and happiness in this world. It's quite bluntly said there, you know, forget that. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought that was the strength of the scriptures, that they're extraordinarily honest on, you know, what life is going to be like.
Julie?
He's doing the best he can defense. And when I set the problem up in class, I put it this way. So I think that's a dodge that's not legitimate. I make it very simple. I say, I go to church on Sunday. They ask me to be on God's team. The book, I read the whole thing, says God's team's going to win. You tell me he ain't all powerful, maybe the other side's going to win. You know, this is crucial, the classical monotheism. God's going to win. A friend of mine once met a Satan believer. It was very interesting. The guy said, oh, most of the stuff in the book is right. You know, why aren't you a Christian? He says, oh, very simple. Satan's going to win. Looks like that in the world sometimes. So I don't think the God is not all-powerful and he's doing the best he can defense gets him off the hook. If you hold that, then classical monotheism is out. You know, you're holding that. One of my students called it the God is a wimp theory. He's a nice wimp.
To hold that God to be all-powerful has to force, to coerce, to use, you know, power against people and their will and their own ideas and thinking. That's a power that God won't use. The power that God takes is a power of love, where he tries to attract, he tries to be powerful through being beautiful, being good, being full of light, trying to attract us with the, you know, the one, the true, the good, the beautiful. And because we're free, I mean, we can go to God and say, well, now you got it wrong. If I was making humanity, I could do a better job of it. Okay, I wouldn't make us free. Well, in all over Gonzaga's campus, there's these gray squirrels, aren't they? Gray squirrels everywhere. And they never get up in the morning and go, gee, that was a nice sleep I just had last night, and I hope I can remember what I did yesterday so that I can, you know, do it. They don't have freedom. They don't have thought about yesterday. They don't remember yesterday. They don't anticipate tomorrow. So we could be squirrels. You know, every squirrel is pretty happy. You know, we could be a moose. You know, but we're not. Okay, but every squirrel is a happy squirrel. God, I don't want to be a squirrel.
Go ahead. I'd like to go with a comment that gentleman made in the back. I think he made a really helpful distinction between it seems like, at least as I understand it, in the problem of evil, there's this condition set up where either you have God existing or you have evil. And since evil exists, then there's a problem with God existing. I think that's the way that the problem is generally phrased. If I'm over my right, if I have that.
No, it's claimed that the character of the evil is absolutely inconsistent with God.
Okay, and that's what
it's a different variant if you want to say that the mere fact of any evil is absolutely inconsistent with God.
Well,
I don't think that argument is going to hold very long.
Well, and that's what I wanted to follow up with this question is if we do set up a situation where there has to be this sort of evil that is really robust, and then say that therefore that proves that God doesn't exist, well then we actually have to account for that evil without God's existence. So we're in this world, we've got pain that's a material process because nerves are affected, or so we have maybe a physical account of pain. Evil equals pain, or evil equals a culturally relative standard that we all came up with as people, or evil is in some way actually a utilitarian standard. But in either one of those situations, we have to ask who decides, who arbitrates, who makes evil what it is. Is it just humans? Well, on some level, we're going to come back to humans being the authority. But then, once we have that account for evil, if we take that back to God, then we have us, basically, as humans, just pointing to God and saying, because of our standard, you're wrong. And that seems to, at least in trying to understand this problem of evil, if that's all evil is us expressing our opinion against God. As I say that, it seems pretty obvious that actually you would need God to have a robust view of evil. So it would seem to, and I'm wanting to work with your point about Boethius, that it seems actually that for you to have a robust enough kind of evil to have the problem of evil, you would have to have God, whose character is the standard, so that you could then accuse God of breaking his own rules. But at that point, there's God, who is the standard for what is good, and it's sort of a moot point. So here's my question. Given that framework, isn't there a psychological problem with evil where we can say, hey, God's all-powerful, why hasn't he fixed my problem yet? But in terms of a logical problem, there is no actual logical problem with evil. Rather, evil is a proof for the Christian God.
I don't want to advance evil as a proof for the Christian God. I do think that, because simply I don't see it. Yeah, I think you could have a view of the world in which there was no classical monotheistic God, in which there was plenty of full-scale robust evil. I don't think that various non-monotheistic cultures have been lacking in.
Well, but we're talking about a Christian account here in the Socratic Club. Wouldn't it be?
Well, it would hold if Buddha hadn't done what he did, I think. Because he was faced with the problem of suffering, and he was faced with the problem of injustice, and he went out and he founded a religion in response to it. So, and there's no monotheistic God in Buddhism at all, as best I can tell. And in that culture, there's no, I don't think they could imagine monotheism until they had it from the outside. So I think historically it wouldn't kind of break that.
Well, just to clarify, though, I'm talking about our definition of evil. Where do we get our definition of evil?
It seems like it's an instinct, a human instinct, that this, you know, suffering is bad. There is justice and there is injustice and it's bad. And I suppose you could work from that to a lawgiver as a sort of separate argument, but in terms of proving the existence of God by the fact that there is evil, I'm not quite sure.
And you don't want to equate suffering with evil.
That's right.
Okay.
You know, there's a difference there. You know, I don't have operations like that. I'm familiar with pain. But it doesn't strike me that's evil unless somebody deliberately, because they hate me, starts sticking a knife in me. Then I'll talk about evil. Until then, I'll talk about I don't like it.
Perhaps one more question. Yes, go ahead.
My question is just more about suffering and the evil. As far as God's participation in our lives, there's a question posed to me if God, you know, like you guys had said earlier, if God can act in a good form through us, then it's kind of okay because it's partially our choice to be his instrument for good. But if you're talking about miracles, where it's strictly God's choice or God's intervention in us, without playing the human ignorance card of the ultimate outcome of something God would do, how do you refute the claim that God's participation or interaction in our lives isn't somehow playing favorites or completely just if he decides to intervene when asked in certain people's lives but not others? If you have two people who are terminally ill and have lived exact same lives, but somehow the prayers of one answered and saved, and the other is not. How do you not see that as some sort of injustice done by God?
First of all, I think that can be kind of helped by the fact that I don't think, so long as there has been a Christianity, anyone has gone and prayed for. You know, you have in the Catholic Mass the prayer for the world, for the needs of the world. You have that, you know, that's been traditional for centuries. So everyone gets prayed for. How does God choose who he helps? Well, I think this kind of goes back to Dr. Wagner's point. How do you know, first of all, how do you know the criteria? Secondly, how do you know there are criteria? You know, why does one person die and another person live? Well, if the person who dies will be saved at this moment, and they die now and they go to heaven because they died now as opposed to 10 years from now, is this an evil done to them? Is this an injustice that they died and the other person lived? Or if you had one person whose suffering inspires someone to live a better life and they're allowed to suffer longer, is this a sheer evil? So we don't know the full scope of the considerations going into that. And then on a certain level, you do have a certain amount of, if one person is reaching out to God, you know, C.S. Lewis loved to talk, when he talked about prayer, would usually say, well, yes, he doesn't always help us when we need it because, well, he likes to be asked. You know, it's a matter of, he's not intrusive. He's not sitting here blazing the room, you know, oh, look, I'm God. You know, it's that very subtle sort of, if you want me, I'm there. If you don't want anything to do with me, I won't touch you. But, you know, if you want me, I'm there. So maybe that.
The other thing I would add, if you really want to get into this problem of evil, there's a very strong tradition in classical monotheistic thought, in all three of the major monotheistic religions, that even at the philosophical level, God is really different. We have a tendency to think of God as sort of like a super parent with the same motivations as a normal parent. But if you read Aquinas or any fairly deep thinker, or if you read any of the mystics, you come out reeling in terms of how different God is. And logically, there's the bite of the logical argument that pops up in Boethius, that we're trying with human categories of what's good and evil to sort through the purposes and goals of a being who is, like I say, way, way beyond human beings. And there is this real tendency to anthropomorphize God. And when you do that, you get these questions. But I think part of the whole package is God is really, really different.
This may, and I don't necessarily want to end on this note, but my response to that question as a therapist is that sometimes that's what it may be, that it is unjust, it is unfair, and then the work is to, how do we accept that? We may not be able to explain it. I think in psychotherapy, and I know this comes into conflict with philosophy, but often the question is why? I need to understand why, and the reality may be we're not going to understand why. We can't know, and so then the job to survive or reduce anxiety or move forward and try to heal is, okay, I can't understand why, and I have to put that aside and try to heal in another way or approach this from a different perspective. So,
And from a Christian point of view, Christianity is not a religion of physical health and well-being. If it were, we wouldn't have Catholic hospitals and clinics and that sort of thing, and doctors and nurses and nuns doing all these hospital work. So it's just on the face of it, we're not a religion of physical health and healing and well-being. And another thought is that in the miracles of Jesus, he's doing miracles to bring people to faith. And even at Lourdes, for example, in France, where people are actually healed, and it's pretty immediate, so few that go to Lourdes, of the tens of thousands that go there every year, it's just a handful that actually get a physical healing. So the point of Lourdes can't be that people in the church, in Christianity, are going to get physical healing. And then the third point is, there was a woman, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who, not a Christian at all, wrote a book on death and dying, and she said, when someone dies, we think, too soon or whatever, we think, oh, but it's too terrible because they would have had this lovely life, in the meadow if they'd only lived. But we don't know that. None of us have a lovely life. And if you are come back from the brink of death, that doesn't mean you're not going to get sick again or, your house won't burn down, your lover won't leave you or, sort of things. So, there's a whole list of things that could happen that would make me unhappy that you're sort of delivered from by death.
Well, I want to thank you for your presence here and your patience. I have one suggestion that you might want to follow. I don't usually advertise in the Gonzaga Socratic Club, but there's a link on the Socratic Club's website of a fascinating film that was just shown on PBS this past week. And you can still view it online until Sunday, I believe, called God on Trial. It's a fascinating premise of inmates at the Auschwitz prison camp who conducted a trial of God. If that's enough to whet your, at least your fascination. The screenplay was written by a Catholic author, very interesting, where the characters they run through some of the standard ways of approaching the phenomenon of evil, the reality of evil and suffering. And especially in that context, you can imagine there's all kinds of potential for making the drama of human suffering very real. If I get a chance for a last note, I would say, when we think about and reflect on the problem of evil, I appreciate especially Father Vebeck talking about the prominence of hope in the Christian view, that as we encounter evil and suffering, that we have at least the promise of hope, of a way of looking at evil that provides some intelligibility and allows us to find meaning and purpose for ourselves in the face of evil and suffering. That doesn't mean, of course, that the questions don't continue coming, which is why we continue asking the questions and exploring them. Thanks again for being